That's official. All right. So this is week three of David and Bathsheba. I think the plan is going to be I'm hoping that we do this in five shiurim. I'm hoping that we can finish in five. It might take a six, but we'll see. The first week we did the basic methodology in terms of how to grapple with the basic approach with these psukim, where on the one hand we need to appreciate and understand the what the psukim are saying on the pshat level, but at the same time realizing that the Navi is writing this with an agenda. It's a good agenda, but it's an agenda, and trying to figure out how to balance what the messages the Navi wants us to get, while also understanding that may not be exactly what's happening in the psukim. We began to actualize that last week as we looked at the beginning of Parak Yud Aleph, and we saw David's first two major sins. The first one, as the Malbim pointed out, was the fact that David was remaining in Yerushalayim. And we pointed out that was not only a problem to stay behind while the rest of the army was out at war, but that this was the first example, and today we'll see many more, of how the David sins in this parak undo everything that he stood for before he became king. All of David's, not just, small things, but major essential values that David has, we see him before he becomes king, those are corrupted in this whole parak. And that was the first one, the first time we ever saw David, well, or the second time, the first time we saw David in a public role was when Goliath faces off against Bnei Yisrael. At that time, Shaul is supposed to go forth and fight against Goliath. He stays behind. Instead, David is the only member of the whole army who's willing to stand up and fight. And now that's been totally reversed. David is sending the whole army to go fight. He alone is the only person who's staying back, enjoying the luxuries of the palace and his naps and everything else in Yerushalayim. And that, the Malbim pointed out, led to everything that followed. And we then discussed at length the story, the initial liaison with Bathsheba, the question of was this adultery, was this not adultery, and different ways of understanding why, even if it was adultery, which many of the Mefarshim and Chazal were open to, it still would not trigger the prohibition of Isser Leboal, Isser Leba'al, because whether there was a get and what exactly that would look like, or whether the relationship was not strictly consensual. We saw there's a lot of evidence that Bathsheba was involved in the sin, but if she had wanted to say no, she would not have been able to. Or the possibility that Uriah is a convert, as the Radak said, and so maybe, as the Rambam talks about, the Geiros at those times was questionable. Different ways of understanding why technically this may not have been adultery, and even if it was, technically, halachically, David would still be able to marry Bathsheba after the fact. But that's regardless, because the Navi is not interested in the halachic technicalities. We care about the broader ethical issue. So we're going to try to tackle this week is the whole Uriah part of the story. So we have the confrontation between Uriah and David in Yerushalayim, and then we have to see the death of Uriah. When Abarbanel, who reads the psukim like at the simple pshat level, so he says that the story, David is guilty of five sins. And two of them we really need to focus on tonight. One is, he says, David is guilty of causing the murder of Uriah. We'll have to look at that. Number two is even more severe, is he says David throws a battle to get David killed. David's responsible for the death of that whole army. So hopefully we'll have time to try to reconstruct what the battle was, and we'll figure out what's going on. So let's load up the screen share and let's jump in. So David, after being told by Bathsheba, remember the only two words that Bathsheba ever says in Sefer Shmuel, if she says, "I'm pregnant, hara anochi." So David has to jump into action. He has to launch the cover up, and the cover up is going to be much worse than the crime, as it always is, right? So he sends to Yoav, bring Uriah to me. Uriah comes. David wants Uriah to go home. He says, "Raid lebeischa, go home. Rechatz reglecha, wash your feet." That could be literal. Abarbanel understands that it's a euphemism for "go be with your wife," because that's the whole reason why David wants him to go on furlough to go home. And what happens? Uriah doesn't do so, right? Uriah stays in the palace. He does not go home. Now, the basic question we need to ask for the psukim, which is coming up, is Chazal are going to explain the defense for David. The defense for David getting Uriah killed is going to be that he was Morid B'Malchus. right? He was a rebel. Now, what's interesting is that Chazal felt the need to offer that defense. In theory, one could have said that David has his rights to send people to war. If he sends people to war, he knows that some of them will die. So in theory, one could have defended David straight up and said, yeah, David did send Uriah, did command Yoav to get Uriah killed, but he did so in war. So it was done in a legal way, right? Chazal are not interested in that approach. The defense that they're going to offer, although we'll see, not everybody agrees to it, is that he was a rebel. So we need to approach this with one of three possibilities. Either that's totally true, I think is one way this is normally understood, that Uriah was completely insubordinate to David. On the other extreme, say that's totally untrue. There's no evidence for this whatsoever. Uriah is a hyper-loyal subject. Or, a middle approach, which is the one we've been trying to really develop this whole time, that maybe technically Uriah would fit the category of Mored Be'Malchus. Technically, David could justify calling him someone who was insubordinate, and therefore the king has the technical right to kill him. However, having the technical rights does not necessarily mean that it is at all the ethical proper thing to do, and the Navi does not care if it was forbidden or whether it was technically permitted, but ethically forbidden. So the first major hint, and we'll see a number of them, that there's something kind of funny happening over here, is when Uriah stays in the palace, right, when he doesn't go home, so the Navi says, Vayeshkav Uriah, so he lay, and now that's a setup, because the expectation would be Vayeshkav im ishto, right, to be shochev, that normally is used, that is often used to mean that there's sexual relations happening over here. But that's not what the Navi says, of course. Instead, right, it's a twist, he sleeps, Pesach Beis HaMelech, at the door of the king's house, is kol avdei Adonav lo yarad al beisav. And he sleeps at the entrance of the king's house with all of the servants of his master. Now, one could read this innocuously and say, look, Uriah is so loyal that he refuses to go home. But the Malbim senses that there is a funny detail that the Navi is giving us. Why does the Navi have to tell us that not only did Uriah not go home, but that specifically he sleeps in the entrance to the king's palace? The king's palace is big, and Uriah is a very high-up commander in the Jewish army. If Uriah wanted to get a room in David's palace to spend the night, he could have done that easily. And there are plenty of servants' quarters in the palace, right? Uriah, if he doesn't want to go home, he could get himself a room. So why is it that of all places, he specifically sleeps at the entrance to the king's palace, on the floor, in front of all of the servants? When I went to MTA for high school, so the kids who came up on the bus from Brooklyn, so it was, tons of traffic. So it was like an hour and a half bus ride. So the kids would take their pillows and blankets and they would have them on the bus. And then they got home. They got to school. So a long school day, they got the pillow and blankets. So great. No need to go to class. So, you walk through the halls and you'd see kids, like lying and taking naps in the hallway, right in front of the entrance, like every classroom with blankets and pillows. So that's exactly what Uriah is doing over here. He's not just sleeping, but he's sleeping in full public view. So the Malbim understands that this is the first hint that the Navi is giving us, that Uriah is sending a message to David. And Uriah is going to get pretty harif in a minute. But the Malbim writes, Uriah is upset that he is being sent home. He's going on furlough. We can understand why. We can imagine, what were the people saying in the army when knowing full well that David was at home relaxing while they were out month after month fighting way out on the other side of the Jordan River. We can imagine the anger and the resentment that would build up in the army, right? We can imagine the feeling of the band of brothers as they're coming together while their king is out enjoying himself. We can imagine the anger which was smoking and simmering in Uriah maybe for weeks and now weeks. Now the king tells him to go home and tells him to enjoy himself, to behave like David is behaving instead of being with all of his men. Uriah is horrified by that. Not only does Uriah refuse to do so, but Uriah refuses to do so in a way where he is broadcasting that to the rest of, to the whole palace. All of the servants are seeing Uriah publicly disobeying David and sleeping out in the open instead of going home, right? Now, that would be insubordination. Could one call that moreid b'malchus? Technically, one could. He is being insubordinate to David. He is undermining David against the servants in the palace. But at the same time, he's doing that out of loyalty to the cause, right? This is not a traitor or a rebel. This is somebody who disagrees with his king and therefore is protesting the way he's going. Now, this, David is surprised at this. So David is told this didn't happen. And then David says, well, what's going on, right? Why didn't you go home? Now, you get the sense, and Rav Meidan in his book makes this proposal, that it sounds like there was a longer conversation here. And the Navi is just boiling it down into a couple of psukim. Because David seems to ask a pretty innocent question. You came from a long way. Why don't you go home? And Uriah like erupts in a passionate exclamation. So that would just be kind of weird, kind of a strange conversation for like, you know, to shift and escalate that quickly. But that's the picture that the Navi gives us. And we have to read the Pasuk Yud Aleph inside to get just a sense of the tone of Uriah's response to David, who's telling him, why don't you go take a vacation? Why didn't you go down to your house? Right? The Aaron is out in a tent, and Israel is out in tents, and Yehuda are out in tents. And my master Yoav and my master's servants are camped out in the field. Vani avo albesi lechov lishtos v'lishkav mishti. I should go home to eat and to drink and to sleep with my wife. Chayacha, I swear by your life, v'chein afshecha, by your life, by your soul, im eses adavar hazeh, I would do such a thing. That is not something that Uriah says calmly, right? There's a lot of repetition in this pasuk. This is an emotional sentence. And every word that Uriah is saying is dripping with anger and revulsion against what David is telling him to do. Right? First, what's he saying? He's saying everybody is at war. The Aaron, Yisrael, Yehuda. He doesn't just say Hatzavai. He could have said, you know, Hatzavai, Yashum Basuko. No, no. Ha'aron, Yisrael, Yehuda. Everybody is there. Hint, hint, except for David. Right? That's piece number one. Piece number two, the Malbim flags this. It's a fantastic insight that the Malbim has. Is they look at the difference, right? Yisrael and Yehuda are dwelling in Sukkot. They're dwelling in tents, booths, and Yoav and his servants, right, are out in the field. So I'm just going to scroll down for a second to get to the Malbim's insight over here. Right, and the Malbim says, look at that, that Yoav. Right, and the, you know, the senior officers, including Uriah, the professionals, they're sleeping out in the fields. They don't even get tents. They are so dedicated to the cause that they're sleeping out in the wide open. Right, the regular militia, at least they have tents. The professional soldiers, Yoav and his men, they are totally in. They are totally roughing it. They don't even have tents. Right, they're exposed to the chariv bayom v'karach b'layla. They're roasting in the day and they're freezing at night. What's the message that Uriah is sending? Right, he's building up. That isn't just a refusal. It's a horror. Everyone else is so all in. The suffering and the dedication and the sacrifice is so intense from the soldiers. Everyone's there. And even more from Yoav, and you want me to go home. It's piece number two. Then piece number three in Uriah's response. And this is the most famous one, because this is the one that the Gemara jumps all over, and for good reason, is Uriah tells David, Adoni Yoav, right? He says, my master Yoav. Now, is that true? I mean, technically speaking, it's true, because Uriah is in the army, and Uriah really seems like somebody who is not just a professional soldier, but his life is the army, right? There's a certain irony with Uriah and David. It does not seem, at least in Parak Yud Aleph, we get no indication. This we know. Uriah and Bathsheba do not have any children together, right? It seems like they are very newly married. So we know the psukim in Devarim, which tell us which Jewish soldiers are supposed to go home, Uriah probably should not be in the battlefield. Uriah should be at home with Bathsheba, and David should be out in the field with his men, right? But in this parak, everything is topsy-turvy. Uriah, instead, is out in the field, and David is at home with Bathsheba, right? Everything is backwards of the way it is supposed to be. But when Uriah tells Yoav, Adoni Yoav, sorry, when Uriah tells David, Adoni Yoav, my master Yoav, so Gemara says, wait a second, what do you mean my master Yoav? It's supposed to be my master David, right? So the Gemara in Shabbos says that's exactly the point we could flag as Mori B'Malchus, that, right, he's held innocent of murder. My time, Mori B'Malchus, he was a rebel. Tamalei, Adoni Yoav, Avdi Adoni, Alpanei Asad Esodim, Nazchonim, my master Yoav, says Rashi, Lav Orach Ara, it's not normal. L'kabel Alav Marus Achirim B'Fnei Amel. It is not normal for one to call someone else his master in front of the king. Now, Rashi was actually being a little bit modest. It's not just that it is not normal for somebody to stand in front of a king and call someone else his master. It is unprecedented. This is the only time in all of Tanakh that we have a king in the room and someone else is called Adoni. That never happens. If the king is in the room, he is always the Adon, always. If the king is not in the room, then things can change. So when Yehuda and Yosef have their confrontation in Vayigash, Paro isn't there. So Yehuda can call Yosef Adoni. But if the king is in the room, nobody else is ever called an Adon, except for this moment right over here, right? So putting these three together, you know, number one, Uriah's emphasis on everybody being there when David is not. And Uriah's, you know, enhancing of Yoav's sacrifice in contrast to David. And we know the whole political sensitivity between Yoav and David, you know, the general of the army, who really is totally independent-minded, and David. And then calling him Adoni Yoav, the Avdei Adoni, who my master's servants. They're not, I mean, they're really David's, right? Who's in charge of the army over here? Is the army loyal to the general, or is the army loyal to the government? Like calling the army the servants of Yoav, I mean, that's a very, very loaded statement, right? He's saying that the army is loyal to Yoav. So this could be understood as an insubordinate soldier whose primary loyalties lie with his general over his king. And then he's a mechutzef when he responds to David, right? He's a mechutzef. He doesn't say, should I go? I'm going to go to my house, and I'm going to eat, and I'm going to drink, and I'm going to sleep with my wife, right? Piling it on. Chayacha v'chaynafshacha ma'asa adavar hazeh. Right? God forbid, and he says it twice, God forbid if I would do such a thing. So one could call Uriah a Mori B'Malchus. Now, as you said, there's another way of reading the psukim here, which is absolutely not. Nothing going on. Where is the first place we find that view, which totally rejects this whole thing, everything we're building up before? In the Gemara itself. Gemara itself, right after it brings the view that Uriah was a rebel, that Uriah was a Mori B'Malchus, it immediately quotes Rav. Amar Rav, ki ma'ayin pei b'David, if you really analyze the story of David and Bathsheba, lo mishkachas pei bar midu Uriah, you will find no sin except for killing Uriah. Rav apparently thought that he could get David off on the adultery charges, but he thinks he cannot get him off on the murder charge. Because the Navi next week is going to, we'll see, the Navi is going to convict David of executing Uriah. Right, and Rashi says, right, Rashi over here, he's holding Uriah responsible. So we do see two different ways of reading the Pesukim already in the Gemara themselves. But let's really try to build up this middle view. And the way to build up this middle view is just look at one more piece in the Gemara. The Gemara says, what did he do wrong? Shahayalacha laduna b'Sanhedrin v'lo danta. You should have judged them in the Sanhedrin, and he didn't do so. Now, what does that mean? And let's take a step back. Rav in the Gemara has a great point. The Navi Nasan is going to walk into David next week, and he's going to say, Oso haragta b'charev b'nei Amon. You killed him with the sword of the sons of Amon. So if we just take, you know, if we put our feet up and relax and say, no problem, Uriah was super loyal to Yoav. He was a total rebel against David. Everything was okay. It doesn't hold up. I mean, Uriah, David's going to get blasted for it. The Navi's going to mention it multiple times. David's going to get punished. The Navi says, you know, because you killed Uriah, the sword will never leave your house. We're going to see child after child that David has die. It's extremely difficult to buy the most extreme version that he really was, you know, a total Mord Malchus, and we're okay with everything that's happening over here. What the Gemara thing is trying to get across is this intermediate view. What does it mean? You should have judged him with the Sanhedrin, and you didn't do so. So it happens to be in the Gemara, the Rishonim try to figure out what exactly halachically is the story with somebody who is accused of being a Mored B'Malchus. The king has a lot more leeway than a regular Sanhedrin does. He's a lot more flexibility. So he's allowed to execute people as being, you know, rebels against the throne. Does he need to go through the legal channels when he does so or not? So there's different evidence in the Gemara. Rashi and Tosfos talk about it. The Turi Evin, though, here, right? The Turi Evin, which is the commentary by the Shagas Aryeh, you know, like 300 years ago or so. So he has probably the best shot in this Gemara. And it gets to exactly the point we're making. That Turi Evin says, it depends. Sometimes a king can try a case of rebellion by himself, and sometimes he can't. It's very simple. If it's a cut and dry case, if it's obvious, then the king can do it by himself. That makes sense because we need the king to be able to take drastic and immediate action. There are times where national security is at risk, the fate of the government is at risk, and we can't spend all that time going through the extensive channels of Beis Din and Edim, and it can take a long time, and that's not going to. However, there are times where it's not clear. Is this rebellion or is it not? In those cases, when there are reasons why the king should suspect that he is not able to make this call on his own, or that it's, you know, this is a judgment call, once it becomes a judgment call, the king should not be the one doing the judging. So Revin says that's exactly what was happening over here with David and Uriah. And if we take a step back and think about what this idea means in general, we could say, look, was Uriah technically insubordinate to David? Yes, he was. Was he chutzpahic? Certainly. Now, at what point does chutzpah cross the line and become insubordination, where he's actively undermining David among his subjects? At what point does insubordination become Mored B'Malchus, which is worthy of being killed? And David, who is so nogea b'davar, David, who is so incentivized to find an excuse to get Uriah killed because he's so desperate to cover up what he did with Bathsheba, is he in a position where he at all should be the one making this call? Maybe it's true that Uriah technically fits the bill for what one could call Mored B'Malchus, right? But is that the ethical judgment over here? When the halacha gave us the adin of Mored B'Malchus, did it have in mind somebody who was insubordinate to the king because he was so loyal to the cause? Of course not. Of course not. So David is using the halacha over here to get what he wants and then convincing himself that he's right all along, right? He's going to convince himself that what he did was right. That's how the Yetzer Hara works, right? Nothing is more powerful than self-rationalization. But right, I think that's what's probably going on over here. There are enough hints in the Psukim that Uriah is doing a whole lot more than one normally would, or maybe than one normally should. At the same time, you can't say that this is, you know, Tzedek and Mishpat, what David's response is going to be. In fact, this really is the second major fundamental betrayal that David has of himself. If last week we saw David betraying himself because he wasn't going out when everyone else was, well, now what's the betrayal over here? David's hallmark characteristic. He'll do this, you know, in the next paragraph, but his trademark strength is his ability to absorb mussar from whoever gives it. It's his ability to have the humility and the integrity and the self-confidence to change course as difficult as that may be, when someone calls him out on being wrong. And that's something that we know full well sounds super easy to do in theory, but is brutally difficult to do in practice. But that happened, you know, the most prominent example, which Chazal draw all the parallels between that story and this story, is the story of David and Abigail and Nabal in the 25th chapter of Shmuel Aleph, when David has spent months protecting Nabal's flocks, and then he asks him to just give them some food so that his men can eat and not starve, and Nabal totally rejects him, and David is furious, and David, you know, has his whole army strap on their weapons to go to war, and the Navi draws parallels between David and Esav as he goes to attack. And Abigail marches out in front, and Abigail confronts David, and it's brilliant what she does, but she corrects his course, and David immediately changes course. When David wants to do things, and the Navi tells him to do something else, or he asks the Urim V'Tumim, and he's told to do something else, he changes course as soon as he's being told he's done something wrong. That happens time and time again, or happened time and time again for David in the pre-king days when he was on the run. Now, all of a sudden, we're getting somebody who now is king, and we're being corrupted minute by minute, who is getting on-point Musar from one of his generals. Maybe wasn't given in the smoothest possible way. Maybe Abigail was much more nuanced than and you know, emotionally intelligent than Uriah was in the way she delivered the message. But the bottom line is that for David, instead of accepting the Musar from wherever it's given, he shoots the messenger, right? He turns around and declares him a Mori B'Malchus and has to have him killed. So again, with tactical justifications, but the tactical justifications belie the corruption that's happening to David underneath as it happens. So, all right, let's now move on to what actually takes place. So David tries one more time. He really goes all out. He tries to get Uriah drunk. It still doesn't work. Uriah is actually steadfast. So you got to give David credit. He tries as hard as he can to not go in this direction, but ultimately he feels like he has no choice. And we'll talk about this more next week, because that's how the Yetzer Hara works, right? Once you start to slip with the Yetzer Hara, then eventually the pleasure is all gone, and you start sinning because you feel you don't have a choice. And that's what's happening with David. So David sends a letter to Yoav, and it's pretty eerie because he has Uriah himself bring the letter. I forgot to update the numbers. Okay, got to fix that. And the question is, what exactly happens? So if we just read the few psukim over here, we will get one view of what happens, and that is the view that the Abarbanel embraces. But as we'll see, it has serious problems. So David writes to Yoav, and first the Navi says he writes a sefer, right? So it's a whole long letter. Sefer, it's a whole long scroll being written to Yoav. Vayachtov ba-sefer le'mor havuas Uriah al mul pnei milchama hazaka. Bring Uriah, right, to where the fighting is fiercest. V'shavta me'acharav, you'll turn around from him, b'nikav ha'meis, he'll be smitten and he'll die. It sounds pretty cut and dry, right? The image we have is the message being given to Yoav is we're going to put Uriah in the worst part of the battle. The army will march forward. Then we'll somehow give a command to the army to turn around, leave Uriah isolated by himself, and Uriah is going to die. Right? That's the image that we're given over here. If this is the case, there will be one fatality in this battle, and it will be Uriah. So then the Navi tells us, Yoav was besieging the city, so he puts Uriah in the place where he knows the fighting is happening. So the men of Ammon come out of the city, right? They're being besieged, so sometimes they emerge from the city to attack the army. And some of the soldiers fall. Avdei David, that means the professional soldiers. So there's a loss here. Vayamaskam Uriah also dies. So sounds, implication is that Yoav did exactly as David ordered. They put Yoav and Uriah in the front. They turn around. Uriah dies, and that's it. And in the course of doing that, right, some other people die as well. The question is that really what happened? So Abarbanel I think here goes, I mean, Abarbanel goes pretty extreme, and he's not even so sure he's right about it. But Abarbanel says the fourth sin that David had was that he, not only did he get Uriah killed, but he got Uriah killed by people from Ammon. Interestingly, he thinks that was really bad. You know, if you want to kill Uriah, be straight about it and do it yourself. Don't leave it to Ammon to do your dirty work. By the way, this is David's third major self-betrayal. Earlier, when he was still in Hebron, before he became king of all of Israel, Yoav killed Avner, the general of Ishbosheth, right? Formerly the general of Shaul. Everyone thought that David had arranged it because it was very politically advantageous to David. And David made a whole show. I wasn't involved. My hands are clean. I don't do these kind of things. Yoav and Avishai, they're very fierce and headstrong. I can't control them. I would never use Yoav to do my dirty work. Chas v'shalom. That's never how David would operate. And all of a sudden here, that's exactly what David does, right? David uses Yoav to do his dirty work. David uses the Ammonim to do his dirty work, right? It's not great. It's not great. Then Abarbanel says that you see how bad this was because it was impossible for David to get Uriah killed without killing many other Jews. Why? There was no way that Yoav could have possibly just left Uriah by himself against the Ammonim. So in order to accomplish David's commandment, he had to cover it up by having a few other men there as well. The way Abarbanel understands is that Yoav had to sacrifice a few other people so that, you know, Yoav would not be the only one dead. Otherwise, it would be obvious. Like, what exactly is it supposed to look like getting Uriah killed all by himself? Major problem with this idea is that if this is true, if we're holding David responsible, not only for killing Uriah, but for killing, you know, as he says, Rabbim mi Yisrael, many other Jews, why is that crime something that the Navi never calls him out for? Right? This should be, and this is a great example of how the Navi can make things sound worse than actually they are when we dig under the surface, because we want to make this look bad. The whole point of this parak is to say, look how dangerous the kingdom is. Even David as a king can be corrupted. And it sounds at first glance, like it's not, but the Navi is going to punish David for killing Uriah. What about killing everyone else? Where's that? And that you don't see. Let's think for a second and wonder. You know, the way Abarbanel suggests this over here, if you look on the virtual Beit Midrash, Rav Amnon Bezak explains the psukim this way. His commentary there is essentially in line with Abarbanel. So he says, okay, David told Yoav, get Uriah alone killed. Now, that's impossible. So Yoav has to finagle things, has to change things around to accomplish that goal. But like, David isn't stupid. Like, you know, he's a pretty experienced and talented general. I mean, he's been fighting as a general for almost his whole adult life. His entire adult life, he's been fighting. He knows. So Rav Bezak suggests that David was so desperate to cover up the crime that he sent instructions which were illogical. It just shows the emotional turmoil that he has. But truth is, that isn't the sense that we get from David beforehand. David writes a whole letter to Yoav. And the Navi talks about it twice. I think the Malbim, I'm just going to plug in my computer while I talk. The Malbim points out that David seems to be writing a whole long letter about the battle. You know, the Malbim does not say this, but it sounds like David has been, you know, whether scared straight, he's been affected by Uriah's mussar. After neglecting the battle, he's now getting involved. He's giving a long, detailed military instructions. We're going to see Yoav is going to send back detailed military instructions as well. David is beginning to get, he's realizing, and this is smart. I mean, David is certainly politically aware. I'm just going to bend down for a second to plug this in. Right. David is aware that he's losing control of the army. If this is how his commander Uriah is talking, it's probably how other soldiers are talking as well. He needs to get more involved. So he sends a whole letter with instructions about the army. And it sounds like he's pretty calm when he does this. He's had a couple of days. He doesn't sound desperate in the moment. So it's difficult to read the psukim as saying that David sent an irrational military command. And this doesn't sound like, it doesn't really fit. It doesn't sound like David. So what exactly did he command? So let's look at the rest of the psukim describing the aftermath of the battle. We'll introduce a suggestion that Rav Meidan makes, and then I'll make a suggestion of my own, see what everyone thinks. So Yoav sends a letter to David. And he has a messenger to tell him, kind of interestingly, Kol Divrei HaMelchama, the whole battle, right? David wants to know now about the whole battle, Kol Divrei HaMelchama. And then he says to the messenger, after he finished telling about the battle, so if the king gets angry and he asks, why did you approach the city to fight? You know that they could throw things down at you from the wall. Then he introduces Avimelech from Sefer Shoftim, the son of Gidon, the first Jewish king, who's a terrible king. He just has civil wars. And he gets killed by a woman who throws a millstone down on him and cracks his skull. So why did you attack the wall? So you should say, Uriah Hachiti Mace, right? Oh, Uriah also died. So there's stuff here that doesn't sound like it fits the original version of the battle we were given. I thought what was happening was Uriah and his men were going to advance against the army. Then they would pull back and Uriah would be left alone and he would be killed out in the field. That sounded like it was David's command. From Yoav's letter, it doesn't sound like Uriah was killed by himself, isolated in the field. It sounds like the problem was the Jews got too close in attacking the city, and Uriah got killed from somebody who was shooting down from the wall. So what exactly was this battle? How did Uriah actually die? So we have one more version of the battle that we're given. The messenger comes to David, and the messenger tells David, "Ki gavru aleinu ha'anashim v'yitzu aleinu ha'sadeh." So the men prevailed against us. So remember, we're besieging them in the city. They come out from the city. They attacked us, and if they gavru aleinu ha'sadeh, so it sounds like they pushed us back from the walls. Then v'niyale ha'pasach hashar. Then we fought them until we got to the gate. So it sounds like the Ammonim attacked, the Jews counterattacked, and then when they counterattacked, the Jews got to the wall, and when they got to the wall, some of the Ammonim on the wall shot, and they killed some of the soldiers, and they also killed Uriah. So what happened? What happened to David's commandment about leaving Uriah by himself? We have no indication here that that's what happened at all. What's happening with the Ammonium attacking and the Jews retreating and then the Jews fighting and then the Jews getting killed by the wall? It's very unclear what actually is happening. So the basic suggestion that Rav Meidan makes, and it goes off in this whole thing, but I think there's a much simpler way to say it, is we know a tried and true military technique that the Jews have had when fighting against the walled city. Yehoshua already deployed it against the second city that they conquered, the city of Ai, which is the technique of the feigned withdrawal, right? You pretend to retreat. That way you get the enemy soldiers out of the city. Now, the way he describes what happened, I really don't see it in the second, frankly, but the way he describes what happened was the plan was supposed to be for Uriah to like be the bait with some of the men to get the Ammonim out of the city. And then just as Yehoshua does over here in Parak Ches of Yehoshua, where the main army retreats, but then the secret army runs out and runs inside the open gates and comes into the walls of the city. So that would have been the same thing that would have happened over here. Uriah would, would retreat. That would attract the Ammonim, and then Yoav would sneak into the city. But I think it's probably a more simple way to understand what's happening, which squares the way Yoav and the messenger describe the battle and explains what David's commandment was. and lets us understand why, on the one hand, it was a commandment that would get David Uriah killed, would also explain how David would rationalize it to himself, and would explain everything that Yoav is doing. Because one of the things we need to notice is that Yoav sounds pretty defensive, right? Yoav sounds like things went wrong over here. For some reason, he has to justify himself, right? He's going to tell the messenger, if David gets angry, here's how to explain what went wrong, right? So what happened? What exactly went wrong? So here, I think, is the simplest way to understand what actually happened in the battle. David's idea was, we're going to have a feigned retreat, just like we had in Sefer Yehoshua. That is, and then when there's a retreat, so some of the bravest men are going to be the rear guard, right? Which is going to, you know, try to let everyone else behind them retreat while they fight back. That's the description of, right? You'll leave Uriah behind and he's going to get killed. It's a very risky job. But what's the ultimate goal? The goal is to bring Ammon out from the walls so that then they can get the enemy soldiers out of the city, and then they can kill the enemy soldiers, right? It's a way of luring them out of their defenses so that Yoav can destroy the enemy army. Someone is going to have to play that role. Someone's going to have to take on that very high-risk mission of leading the soldiers who are going to fake the retreat. And some of them are going to have to try to protect the soldiers as they're retreating to make sure that they're not all routed. The person you're going to choose is your leading commander, someone who's an excellent warrior. You're going to choose Uriah, and he's going to take the mission. No one's going to be suspicious of that whatsoever. So the hope that David had was he can have his cake and eat it too. The hope was going to be that Uriah would be killed in a heroic battle, and his death would be as part of a strategy to help the Jews totally destroy the enemy Ammonite army. Problem is that that's not how things actually worked out. So what happens, right? To some degree, things work the way they thought. Gavru aleinu anashim etzilenu hasadeh. We did lure them out. And initially, right, we retreated. The Ammonim chased after us. Then we counterattacked. We counterattacked. The problem is that there are two problems. David has a problem, and the army, and Yoav has a problem. David's problem is that Uriah is such a good warrior that even though he took on that super dangerous mission, he was not actually killed in the beginning of the battle, right? He helped defend the Jewish army as they're pretending to retreat. He wasn't killed. He stays alive. They turn around and they counterattack, and Uriah's still going strong. And the second problem is that the strategy wasn't successful. They were not able to surround and cut off the enemy soldiers. They pushed the enemy soldiers back, but the enemy soldiers managed to get to the gate of the city. And it is at that point, right, as the Jewish soldiers don't wipe out the enemy troops, but then they hurl themselves against the wall. So it's at that point that Uriah is killed. So now Yoav has some explaining to do, because the battle did not go the way that they had hoped. They didn't win. Why did they throw themselves against the wall when Uriah was still alive? And here Yoav is really either saying one of two things, right? Either Yoav is saying, look, I had to keep up the counterattack because I had to get Uriah killed. Uriah's still alive, so I still got to attack until Uriah's dead. I think much more likely, though, because this would really fit Yoav's personality. Yoav, who is the hyper-aggressive, fearless general, is he just kept on pushing the fight, right? The hope had been to cut off the enemy army. Well, that didn't happen, but let's just go for it and push all the way to the walls of the city and try to break through even without having surrounded and cut off the enemy soldiers, right? He's hyper-aggressive. It doesn't work. He gets burned for it. They lose the battle for it. But when Yoav makes his report back to David, so how's he going to explain himself? Well, he's going to protect himself, right? He's going to say, David, I was pressing against the wall to get Uriah killed. Right? Now, could that be Yoav sending David a message, hint, hint, you know, I know that there was something up and I have leverage over you. Maybe, you know, is it a coincidence that Yoav references a story where a woman brought down the king? Maybe yes, maybe no. It's also possible that Yoav, he's not, you know, like blackmailing David. He's just rationalizing, right? He knew, look, David, you can't be upset at me because I got Uriah killed, right? I fulfilled that part of your command, right? So I think putting that all together, that helps us understand what David was thinking, right? It's a brilliant self-rationalization. He could convict Uriah of being a Marduk Malchus, but he also, the orders themselves that he gave, it was a regular, sophisticated battle plan. Someone's going to have to die, or someone's going to have to take on great risk of dying. And Uriah happens to be the perfect person for the job. Now, you know, he's commanding it that way because that's what he wants to do. You know, this morning, you know, doing this model Besdin program with these guys in the Skokie Shiva. So the model Besdin case that they're talking about is confidentiality. It's all the concerns, right, about, you know, breaching confidentiality versus when you have to give information. So we were talking this morning about the Chafetz Chaim's requirements for giving Lashon Hara L'Toeles, right, beneficial Lashon Hara. And one of the requirements the Chafetz Chaim has to legalize giving that information is Chafetz Chaim says you can't be biased. You know, if you're biased, then how are you to tell that this is really beneficial Lashon Hara? And it's not just, you know, so the mother calls you up to ask about your roommate, and you know, it happens to be you hate the guy, but how do you know when you say what a rotten guy he is? Is it because he really is that way, or because that's just how you think? Chafetz Chaim thinks that that's one of the requirements for Lashon Hara. You have to check your biases. Okay, which is questionable. Other poskim are not so sure that's the case, but that's happening with David over here. You know, he's giving a regular military commandment, but what's belying all that is the biases he has that he wants Uriah to be the one who's killed. And the Navi is not going to accept any of this as an excuse. We're not going to accept the insubordination as an excuse, and we're not going to accept, you know, the fact that he's just a general at war, and that's what happens in war. That's not going to work either. Even though, you know, he was not trying to lose a battle per se, and you know, definitely was not giving irrational commandments to just have Uriah alone be killed. So just one last thing for us to see. We got to finish the last couple of psukim of the parak. So David then sends the messenger to Yoav, and he says, "Ali Rabbe Nachas Adavar Hazeh. This should not be too bad in your eyes." And here we get to really the worst of David's self-betrayals. He says, "Ki chazav chazeh tochal hacherev. The sword is going to eat this person, the sword is going to eat that person." That's life. That's war. Some people live, some people die. It's all chance. It's all chance. Keep fighting. Pasach avav, v'teshma eshes Uriah, ki meis Uriah isha. Uriah's wife heard. Let's remember the Navi never calls her Batsheva again. Till the end, right? She's always Uriah's wife. Uriah's wife heard that Uriah, her husband, died. She mourns her husband. Three times in one pasuk, we're told that Batsheva is Uriah's wife. And immediately afterwards, David brings her in, and she becomes his wife, and she has a son for him. Right? The Navi is like drilling home the theme that this is Uriah's wife. Vayera devar asher asad l'div b'nei Hashem. What David did was bad in the eyes of God. The first time, as you said, Hashem finally comes into the story. David may have thought that Hashem doesn't see. He may have thought that no one sees what's happening. And the last word of the whole parak is Hashem. Hashem sees what's happening everywhere. Well, I think it's that Mikra, one of the modern Mefarshim, points out the parallel here between what David says and what happened when Hashem is doing. David is saying, "Ali Rabbe Necha, this should not be bad in your eyes." Wishful thinking. It was bad. The whole thing was bad. It was bad in the eyes of God. Now let's just digest, then we'll close for tonight, the levels of self-betrayal that David is having. The corruption that is happening to David, the power, the Yetzer Hara, the opportunities that David has given as king, what has that done to me? We've seen the refusal to step out in the field. We've seen the refusal to take the Musar. We've seen using Yoav to do his dirty work. In the beginning of David's career, Shaul wants him dead, right? But Shaul doesn't want to kill him. So Shaul says, I'll kill him with the Plishtim. Al tiadibo tihibo yad Plishtim. Let the hand of the Plishtim kill him instead. I'll tell him to go get 100 foreskins to have kiddushin with my daughter, and that's going to get him killed. Shaul says it three separate times, right? So David had been the victim of this mindset, and now he's turning it around, and instead of the king getting him killed with the Plishtim, right, now he is the king, and he's getting someone else killed with the Ammonim. It's a total self-betrayal. The breaking up of the married couple, right? David, one of the most traumatic events in David's life has been having the king, only the king could do this, take his wife and give her to another man. Shaul took Michal, Eshes David, and gave her to someone else. Well, now David's doing the same thing, using the power that only the king has to break up a married couple, right? He's taking Bathsheba away from Uriah and giving her to himself. But I think the sixth and most dramatic one is the last one we have here. The line that David says to Yoav. Kaza v'chaza tochal hacharet. The sword eats this person, the sword eats that person. What's David saying here? He's saying the world is governed by chance. Life happens, some will die, some will live, it's not under our control. A totally callous, chance-oriented worldview. So that happens to be the world's view of Amalek, right? That the world is governed by chance. You know, it's Rosh Chodesh Adar, so we appreciate that. Amalek, which happens to be the ideology which failing to fight it is why the previous king got fired, and successfully fighting it demonstrated that David was the rightful king. David, of all people, who is so hyper-aware of Hashem's involvement in this world, who is so locked in with emuna and bitachon, and awareness of Hashem's protection and Hashem's judgment and Hashem's involvement. And that happened time after time before he became king. All of a sudden now, right, David is imagining that the world is governed by chance. There's no higher power involved over here. He's the king. He's the one acting behind the scenes. No one figures out what he's doing. And the rest of the world is governed by chance. Right? That is a shocking line for David to say. And in his whole worldview, David, who mentions Hashem's name endlessly before he became king, Hashem's name is always on his lips. This is the Mechaber of Tehillim, right? In this parak, as he slips deeper and deeper into sin, he's convincing himself that no one knows what's happening. Hashem doesn't know what's happening. Even he convinced himself that he hasn't sinned. And he enters into a worldview where Hashem is not part of the picture. The world is governed by chance. The last and probably deepest of David's own self-corruptions. So as we conclude studying the chapter of David's sins, right, we've seen how at every stage we can justify on technical grounds. Sometimes we have more confident justifications, sometimes less confident justifications. The one case of recreating the battle, I think we've basically given a pretty robust view that's the opposite of the Abarbanel. But the bottom line is that the Navi is showing us somebody who may not be technically sinning, maybe is technically sinning, but regardless of the question on the technical side, on the ethical side, we see how wrong it is, and we see what that is doing to him, right? Whether or not it's technically on the Shulchan Aruch is not affecting the corruption that is happening to David's core. Every single one of the values he stood for as king is now being undermined. And then the question to have next week is going to be, you know, how do we get out of this? You know, how can we have somebody who has all the power of a king, the Yetzer Hara and the opportunities that it provides of a king? If David can't control it, if David's going to be corrupted, then what hope does anybody have? Maybe the answer is nobody, but we'll have to see. So we'll get back, you know, next week, we'll have the message being sent by Nasan Hanavi. What is Hashem's response going to be? What is the punishment for this crime? And then finally, what's David's response? How can somebody who has fallen so quickly and so far, what is the pathway going to be to turn it around and get to the redemption that somehow we know is at the end of the story, even though where we stand there now, we're not sure how it's going to get there. So I'll close and answer questions up here. Otherwise, thanks everyone. I'm looking forward to learning more next week.
Yashkoch, thank you so much.
Okay, Yashkoch.
Good.
Thank you. Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Is there any parallel, going back to the beginning of the Pirates, when Oreo was giving the argument that everybody's out to battle and you're not David, is there an irony in there to when David is talking about bringing the Aro and building the base of Megiddo, and when he says, you know, I don't want to butcher it, but like, Anochi Yoshe Beit Arazim, the Aron Yoshe the Kiryat Yarim, or something like that, meaning it seems to be evocative of sort of similar language about look where everybody is versus look where I am, and nature versus material. I don't know. There seems to be some.
Yeah, I think that makes. I think I hadn't thought of that, but I think there is a lot to work with that. And we'll see next week. You know, after David wants to build a Beis Hamikdash for Hashem in the, you know, the good old days over there. So that was the first prophecy he got from Nasan, right? The second prophecy he's going to get from Nasan is going to be next week. And it is going to be a total inversion of that first prophecy. Mm-hmm. So to suggest that along with the inversion of the prophecies, we also have like a total, you know, inversion of David's mind view from being the one who can't believe that he's in the palace while Hashem is outside to being the person who has no problem being in the palace while the, well, because it's a great point. Not only is the army outside, but right, but Uri is saying the Aron is outside and David seems totally at ease with that. So I think that we could put that on the list, right, of how David is just transforming from what we've seen from before. I like it a lot. I think it was awesome.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, have a great night, and looking forward, God willing, to next week. Okay. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.